Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Jeffrey Singer, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute, who works in the Department of Health Policy Studies. He's a nationally recognized thought leader in health policy, particularly the harmful effects of drug prohibition. He has written extensively about the importance of harm reduction, and he recently published a report titled Cops Practicing Medicine, a well-researched analysis of America's poorly constructed prohibition policies and its effects on the patient-doctor relationship. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Singer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Let's jump right into the main issue at hand, which really highlights the work that you have been doing at the Cato Institute. Few have tied together the historical elements of the war on drugs with today's modern opioid epidemic. There seems to be a cognitive dissonance in looking at the two, as many today forget that physicians have been targeted by federal agencies in the past. You astutely draw out that relationship, the past and the present. What elements of today's opioid epidemic fit within the failed prohibition policies of the past?
Well, yeah, in cops practicing medicine, what my colleague Trevor Burris and I do is we show that basically up until the beginning of the 20th century, people viewed currently illicit drugs. Well, first of all, they weren't illicit. They were all legal. And it was commonplace for people to respect everyone's right to self-medicate. They understood that some people develop problems with particular substances, just like they do with alcohol. But they viewed it as a personal problem. They viewed it with compassion. They oftentimes viewed it as a health problem. They didn't view it as something evil that needed to be stomped out. Then around the beginning of the 20th century, attitudes towards the currently illegal drugs changed, and a number of people began to think of them as vice, using these drugs as vices. And they began to demonize not only the drug, but the people who use those drugs. And to a significant extent, there were racial interplays, too. For example, the earliest of the currently illegal drugs to be made illegal were opium and opioid derivatives. And that was largely because it was associated with Chinese immigrants who came to this country, oftentimes in the West, to work on the railroads. And they had opium dens. And there were actually articles written in such prestigious papers as the New York Times talking about our white daughters lying side by side with Chinamen, as they would say. So it's interesting that the first state in the union to outlaw opium was California.
Wow.
And one of the last states, this is almost counterintuitive based upon the way we think of things today, one of the last states was Mississippi. But then Mississippi didn't have a lot of Asians in this population, but California did. And then cocaine was associated with blacks. And in fact, there were New York Times had articles in the paper talking about scientists believe that cocaine makes, quote unquote, Negroes impervious to bullets. Sure. And also some of it was based upon there was resentment among a lot of white workers in the Northeast who were getting competition from the influx of black people from the South looking for work in the Northeast. Many of them were willing to work for lower wages and longer hours, and rumors started floating around that there's no way those people can work that hard and that long. It must be the cocaine that's fueling their energy and their work ethic. So those are the kind of things that you cannot ignore. They were components. And of course, it's easier to get away with legalizing and abusing people. Illegalizing, rather, and abusing people who use some drugs when they're associated with groups of people who at a given point in time are in the margins of society. They're not considered part of the majority. So the majority, even if they don't have any animosity towards these particular groups of people that are being singled out, their attitude is, well, it doesn't involve me, so it's not my problem. So that helped a lot. So around 1914, the United States passed, the United States Congress passed the Harrison Narcotics Act. Which in its day, they were still respecting the Constitution. So they didn't prohibit any of these drugs. They just put a tax on it, and which is within Congress's constitutional authority. And they had a whole series of requirements. It was enforced by the Treasury Department. And the requirements were that you had to keep track, basically, of sales of these drugs. And a certain list of drugs, including opium and opium derivatives and cocaine, were not allowed to be sold without the tax being paid, records being kept. And but the American Medical Association was very worried about this because a lot of these drugs were commonly used for decades, if not centuries. And like I say, a lot of these were over-the-counter remedies. For example, heroin, which is the brand name for diamorphine or diacetylmorphine that Bayer gave it in the 1890s, among other things, it was in a low dose. It was a children's cough syrup. So people would buy these drugs. And of course, there were people who developed problems with them. Most didn't. And so the American Medical Association were very concerned about this might be encroaching on their ability to practice medicine. But they got Congress to put in the law that doctors will be allowed to prescribe these medicines and people will be able to purchase it with prescriptions in the course of their usual medical practice. And that was the language used. The American Medical Association felt, okay, so we're all right. Well, doctors had a much actually more humane attitude towards these drugs back then, as still many do today. And so they recognized that some people would not necessarily be addicted to these drugs, but would have develop a dependency if they've been taking these drugs a long time, and they would get symptoms of withdrawal if they didn't get access to these drugs. So when patients would come to them now after the passage of the Harris Narcotics Act and describe to them symptoms they were getting when they couldn't get the drugs, which incidentally in the early 20th century, more women used opioids like morphine elixir than men. It was just, and we get into why, but That was a fact. So the doctors would basically say that, well, you've developed a dependency on this drug. If you want me to give you something so you could avoid going into withdrawal, let me give you a prescription for this drug and take this whenever you feel like you're getting withdrawal symptoms, which was a nice, actually proper, humane attitude that doctors had. All of a sudden, Treasury agents, because they didn't have a DEA in those days, started busting down doctors' offices' doors and arresting them. And the doctors would protest and say, what are you talking about? It says that I could prescribe this to people in the course of my usual medical practice. And the Treasury agents, not doctors, said, well, we don't consider treating drug dependency or addiction. In those days, addiction wasn't even considered on a list of mental health disorders.
Right.
You don't consider addiction or dependency to be the course of a normal medical practice. We don't think that's appropriate medical practice. And nevertheless, many doctors persisted in doing this because they thought this was humane. In fact, some of them felt, look, if I don't prescribe it for them, they're going to get it on the street because withdrawal is a very terrible experience to go through. They're going to try to find a way to get it. And this is a much safer supply, the actual prescription medicine. So there were a whole series of cases in the early 1920s, several of which went up to the Supreme Court. And then the Treasury agents, of course, were very cleverly selecting certain egregious cases that they knew would do battle on appeal and take them up to the Supreme Court. Because there were some obvious cases of doctors who actually were taking advantage of the fact that the drugs were otherwise prohibited, and they were, for all intents and purposes, acting as drug dealers. So that was harder to defend. So they got the Supreme Court on a couple of occasions to say things like, well, that clearly isn't the course of normal medical practice, so we're going to side with the Treasury agents. Other times they didn't. Other times the doctors mounted a very good defense. But the Treasury agents, nevertheless, just kept doing this. They were led by zealous anti-drug department heads. And even when there were court decisions that found against them, they just kept arresting doctors until finally one historian we cite in our paper, Rufus King, said that eventually the medical profession withdrew from the battlefield. They just surrendered. They just, like is happening today, they basically said, I just can't, even if I'm if I pursue it long enough and I prevail, it's just not worth it. I'm just getting away from this. So that by the 1930s, we saw so many doctors had been penalized for trying to be compassionate towards their patients that they just stopped prescribing, and they got very frugal with it. Interestingly, at the same time, it was the opposite approach in the UK. And in England, which cooperated with this international treaty that the United States put forth to control opium derivatives around the world and other drugs, the British medical profession and the British policymakers were fine with doctors treating dependency. And to this day, for example, there are doctors who legally prescribe heroin to patients who are dependent on heroin because it's better than them going out on the street to get it. And most what they were noticing is there were a whole lot of people who, as long as they had their safe supply of the drug to which they were dependent, on which they were dependent, they led normal, productive, meaningful lives. They just, whenever they felt like they needed to take the medicine because they felt withdrawal symptoms come on, they would take it. Otherwise, they were married, they had families, they had jobs. And so the doctors in England were saying, why would I want to throw that person's life into chaos? Let me just give that person their medication. And they weren't getting punished in England for that. To this day, like I say, we still have heroin-assisted treatment in Liverpool, for example. It's interesting.
One interesting thing I want to touch on before we get too far ahead into the actual paper itself. Throughout both part one and part two, you talk about certain definitions and terms. You quote heavily, as you had mentioned, from the Harrison Narcotics Act. You also quote from various judicial rulings, and you're very keen on identifying what these phrases were intended to mean and then how they were later reinterpreted. Can you talk a little bit about what problems arose from those reinterpretations or vaguely interpreted terms?
Yeah, I mean, that's just like what happened in the what we call Drug War One. Drug War One was ended in 1970 when the Controlled Substances Act and the Nixon administration replaced the Harrison Narcotics Act. That's when we began Drug War Two. And but in the same in both circumstances, the language was vague enough that it would basically say that doctors can prescribe these things in the course of their normal medical practice for appropriate medical conditions. Well, when you use language like that, a lot of it's subject to interpretation. So you're inviting law enforcement to make the decision, well, this clearly is not normal, not appropriate. But one of the points that we argue, and that's why we call it cops practicing medicine, it's really not up to law enforcement to decide what's appropriate medical practice and what isn't appropriate medical practice. And people who are not in the field don't necessarily understand, although every one of us is eventually going to be a patient, so we will understand it then. But as doctors, you and I understand that things are very, in medicine in general, treatment of medical problems and diseases and disorders is very nuanced. Every individual has a completely different set of circumstances, both psychosocial circumstances and organic physical circumstances, influence the way different treatment approaches work or not. There are drug interactions, there are social responses and psychological responses to medical management. So no two patients are alike, and what may seem to be a sort of an outlier in terms of the way you're prescribing to one patient might be very actually very rational when another health professional understands all of this stuff, is presented with all of the facts about the case, which is why if anybody's going to judge this, it should be your colleagues who do this.
Exactly.
Not policemen or Treasury agents or DEA agents, because they don't understand this, understandably, just like I don't understand a lot about law enforcement.
I think that's a very important point, and let's touch on that, because Dr. Singh, that was one of the most impactful parts in reading through this. You talk about encroachment, you talk about clinical judgment, and you emphasize the importance of physician autonomy. Talk a little bit about that within the context of the article, and then also contrast that with why this imposed standardization is actually harmful to patient care.
Yeah, well, what we talk about in our article is that during drug war II, as non-medical use in this country and associated complications of non-medical use of drugs from the obtained in the black market have been growing exponentially, and this has been demonstrated clearly. So overdoses have been going up, and policymakers are looking for, and the press also, they always like to look for simple explanations followed by simple solutions. And most of these problems are not simple, and the solutions are not simple. So it was, I have said on numerous occasions, in the 70s and 80s, when most of the people dying from drug overdoses that we heard about were inner city people or minorities and sort of marginalized groups, then policymakers and the press were blaming those drug users for making bad choices and for basically acting immorally. But when it started to later in the late 1990s, early 2000s, involve a lot of white middle class people using drugs obtained, diverted prescription pain pills, largely obtained from the black market, we started blaming the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors who were overprescribing, because we didn't want to blame, we didn't want to say that our white middle class sons and daughters were immoral and making bad choices. So we had to find somebody else to blame. But all along, it's been prohibition. And we point that out in our article. But what's been gradually happening is that law enforcement has gotten more and more comfortable with because they've determined, they decided against the evidence that this is all caused by doctors addicting people and creating a population of drug addicts, that it's important for them to intercede into the practice of medicine. So states, every single state now has what they call prescription drug monitoring programs, where every single prescription and transaction at a pharmacy is kept track of in a database. And in many states, law enforcement intermittently just kind of starts going on fishing expeditions through those databases, although 19 states now won't allow them to do that without a warrant. But the Drug Enforcement Administration claims it's exempt from state laws requiring warrants because of the federal government, and they'll go through it. And if a bunch of even if they don't see an actual statutory crime being committed, which, for example, if you had evidence that there was a doctor standing at a street corner selling prescriptions for money, okay, that's a violation of the law. You have grounds to arrest that doctor. But oftentimes they'll be saying, wow, that doctor's prescribed an awful lot of, you know, oxycodone and hydrocodone, much more than other doctors in that area. Let's bust them. And they come in, you know, usually it's kind of funny because they come in, you know, with their bulletproof vests and their helmets and all their military gear, because doctors, of course, we know are armed and dangerous. Of course, if it was a real armed and dangerous person, they probably wouldn't show up until after the damage was done to draw to put the yellow tape saying crime scene, and to draw the chalk drawings around the body. But when it's somebody who's not going to really threaten them, they come in guns, you know, with their big weapons and right through the waiting room. So all the people in the waiting room get to see this. And oftentimes they give a tip off to the local news. So cameras are there. And in many cases, they don't even bother to press charges, because the doctor might be able to actually make a case that it was, if other doctors get to see this, that was completely appropriate. They just want to stop doctors from prescribing opioids. So by usually they'll do something like, say, get the doctor to agree to surrender their narcotics prescribing license. So they've taken that doctor out of circulation. And all the other doctors hearing about this are terrified into not prescribing or prescribing minimally, or if their patient wants a refill, they decide, and I could completely understand this, they decide to refer it to that patient to a pain specialist, to let the pain specialist take the liability risk rather than me. And so this, now what's ended up happening, of course, is this has cut down on the supply of prescription pain pills that can get diverted. In other words, find their way into the black market the law enforcement used the term diversion. So, you know, whether it's from robbing a pharmacy or raiding a truck, that happens, where trucks are bringing, opioids to a pharmacy from a warehouse, or stealing from medicine cabinets or whatever. These drugs find their way into the black market. And as a doctor, I'm sure you would agree, if somebody's going to not recreationally use an opioid, they're much less likely to have problems if they use a diverted prescription pain pill, because we all know exactly what it is. We know it's pure. We know the dose. It says it on the label, as opposed to something that they bought from some guy on the street that might be a counterfeit prescription pain pill, and it's really fentanyl, which is super powerful, or they use heroin, which is actually cheaper and easier to get than diverted prescription pain pills these days. So, so what we've done is we've actually made this growing population of non-medical drug users have to resort to more dangerous drugs, the dose and purity of which they can't be certain of, because we've kind of turned down the spigot on the safer drugs that they get access to. In the meantime, the people who need the drugs are not getting it. So you're seeing people whose lives have been chronic pain patients who they still may not have a perfectly pain-free life, but their pain has been managed to the point where they can go on with and have a job and have a family and enjoy life. And suddenly their doctors are so afraid of getting a bust that they're rapidly tapering them off of these drugs or cutting them off altogether. Doctors are stopping treating pain, and all of a sudden all their population of pain patients find themselves without a doctor. And then when they try to find another doctor, of course, it's in that prescription drug database that this person's gotten drugs from another doctor. So when a person wants an appointment with a new doctor and they look in the database and they say they've gotten it from another doctor, they're immediately labeled as a doctor shopper, probably an addict, probably seeking drugs. So they don't want them. So you have what they call pain refugees, which are a whole bunch of people who've been abandoned by their doctors. Their pain is back. They're miserable. Some of them there have been numerous, reported cases of some of them becoming suicidal and committing suicide. Yeah. Many end up resorting to the black market, hoping to get a hold of the drug. And some of them die of an overdose because they thought they bought hydrocodone or oxycodone, but it was actually counterfeit and it was fentanyl. And we've heard recent reports, I wrote about this, of some people becoming violent against their doctors because their doctors are not, when you have situation. I'm a surgeon. When I see patients getting sent home from the hospital after major surgery with one day's supply of oxycodone, and then they're told to take Tylenol the rest of the way. And then, of course, they call me because they're in pain. And under our drug laws, I'm not allowed to just send in a new prescription for them for more oxycodone. I have to see them in person. So to document that who they are, even though I know who they are. So you have to have this post-operative patient who's in exquisite pain be driven into my office by a spouse or friend or whatever, and so that I could prescribe another prescription. But now this is already in the database as a refill. So I'm aware that I've just given a refill, and the patient is probably aware as well that he or she's gotten a refill. So now if I have to give another refill, I'm starting to get nervous because the cops who are looking over the database may be saying, well, this Dr. Singer's given two refills to this guy. And of course, cops know how much pain medicine is needed after a left hemicolectomy, because, they do left hemicolectomies all the time, and they're very familiar with the kind of postoperative pain people experience. So anyway, this is what's going on. And so you have.
Let's talk about that. I think it's very important to talk about the data creating self-fulfilling prophecies in the eyes of law enforcement, where essentially they're looking at the data. These numbers start to trickle up. They remove the clinical context and they look at the numbers themselves. So they look at the number of refills absent the post-operative clinical context. They look at you providing refills, despite you being the surgeon in these situations. It seems all so rational when you explain it. Why is this being lost, the clinical context that is, why is it being lost in the eyes of law enforcement who are just blindly looking at the numbers and leaving it at that?
Well, you know, law enforcement are people too, and people respond to incentives. So the more drug busts you have, the more notches on your belt, and as a prosecutor, the more plea bargains. I mean, it's too much work to get a person to go to trial. So we have, I think it's something like 95% or more of criminal cases, they get people to actually waive their right to a jury trial and accept the plea bargain. So these are incentives. So it doesn't really, what law enforcement wants is to be able to have an arrest and take a doctor out of the opioid prescribing population. Whether or not that doctor gets convicted is really unimportant to them. Their job is done. They got an arrest and they took another prescriber out of circulation, because that's what usually happens. Many of these doctors never go to trial. They just surrender their license and they say, I'm never prescribing opioids again. I just don't want to take that chance. And their colleagues see what's going on and they don't want to be the next one arrested. So they just stop. And so the mission's accomplished, just like in Drug War One, when the Treasury Department lost some cases before the Supreme Court. By the late 1920s, it didn't really matter anymore because the medical profession withdrew from the field. And so that's what they want. That's the goal.
Yeah. And it's the perception of fear is powerful. Mm-hmm. The perception of fear is extremely powerful, and it creates its own story, its own life, if you will. What I thought was very astute in your paper, Cops Practicing Medicine, was this compendium you guys provided. It distills the complex policies you guys discuss in the white paper itself, but it provides visuals. It provides a nice interactive web interface for people to go through. Why did you guys create that compendium, and what was the impact of that for the general public?
Yeah, well, at the Cato Institute, we have a team of fantastic graphic artists, using digital graphic artists, and they didn't just do this with me. They work with all of our different policy scholars in all the different departments. And so when there's a very important paper that comes out on an issue that needs more attention, what they'll sometimes do is, in addition to the white paper, they call it, and I don't know how the name is derived, but they call it an earthquake. And what they so what they'll do is they'll kind of distill key elements in the text, and they'll create an interactive video. Interactive digital product, so that you're reading certain sections of the paper, key sections that get across the key point, and then there'll be video components. There'll be actual specimens of letters written or narratives provided by people or, you know, patients or doctors, video interviews. And the whole idea is to immerse you in it, almost like an entertainment, and to whet the appetite. And then so for many people who don't have the time to read a 50-page white paper, this kind of gets the point across. And a lot of people respond much more rapidly to visuals, to imagery. So this is designed to kind of stimulate interest. And then at the end of the paper, at the end of the earthquake, rather, is a link to the actual paper for those who want to read it. So we've been finding over the past couple of years that, depending on a select topic, it could be very effective. Sometimes get much more attention than the actual paper itself. The paper is more for, it's more of a scholarly work aimed at policymakers, legislators, those kind of things. Whereas the earthquake is more geared towards informing the general public.
Yeah. How would you define success for this paper? One of the key astute takeaways from this paper was, one, how well researched it was, but two, how it really took on the chronology of America's failed war on drugs and put everything into a broad context, which is very unique for this paper. How is it being received by those who it's intended to be passed along to, the policymakers, the legislators?
Well, it's a little early to tell yet, but there have been on the state level. Well, first of all, I like to think that just the title itself, I want to see that get into the general, vernacular. I want people to keep thinking about, next time they hear about a drug bust, they think cops practicing medicine, because that's what this is. And I don't think anybody thinks cops should be practicing medicine. That's number one. Number two, we have a series of policy proposals, many of which are aimed at the state level, but some at the federal level as well. Obviously, before I get to that, I've been noticing just myself interest generated by many state legislators in different states who've actually contacted me wanting to discuss legislative reform. So one proposal that we got passed in Arizona, where I practice medicine, Arizona became the 19th state to say that if law enforcement wants to look over the prescription drug monitoring program, they have to get a warrant showing there's probable cause of a crime being committed. And it also spells out that if they get a warrant, they don't find a statutory crime, but they suspect there's inappropriate prescribing, then the most they can do in that circumstance is report it to the relevant licensing board, which that's what licensing boards were created for, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then there'll be at least, it'll be assessed by their peers who do practice medicine. So that passed in Arizona, and there are 18 other states that have similar laws. And so we're hoping that we can get that to happen. But this has to happen on a national level as well, because one of the problems, there have been court cases about this, the DEA argues that that doesn't apply to them, that there's federal preemption. So I think Congress needs to pass a law saying the same thing. Now, this should really be relatively non-controversial. I mean, this is basically, it's not in any way for people who want to continue the drug war. This shouldn't stop that. This is trying to prevent innocent physicians and patients from getting caught in the middle of the crossfire. So hopefully that can happen. We're also, I would argue that organizations like the, and I argue this in the paper, that the CDC, for example, which got into the business of prescribing, writing guidelines, which is basically best practices guidelines for how to treat pain. You know, the CDC is supposed to be, it was originally called the Communicable Disease Center, and their main mission has been to prevent the spread of communicable and infectious diseases. And that usually involves epidemiology, tracking a virus or bacterium and the way it spread and finding ways to reduce the spread. But it's gotten way outside its mission, original mission. And now it's busy telling doctors how to treat pain. Actually, and we argue in a paper, you know, professional institutions like, for example, in my specialty, American College of Surgeons or American College of Internal Medicine, et cetera, they're all different specialty organizations and non-governmental organizations. They're nonprofit, and their main job is they have committees that are constantly reassessing the constantly changing knowledge base we have. And as everybody learned during this pandemic, every time we think we know something, we realize we're wrong. So it's constantly changing. And their job is to constantly update what they consider to be best practices. So we don't need the CDC or the FDA or these agencies that were charged with other missions to get in the business of telling healthcare practitioners what best practices should be. We already have those organizations, and they're being pushed aside by governmental agencies. And also, when a governmental agency says, we think this is a good idea, that's a little different than when a professional association says, we think this is a good idea, because obviously that carries weight. And if there's a malpractice lawsuit, the doctor, the defendant doctor is accused of violating best practices, they could cite the best practices recommendations of a specialty organization. But when a government says, we're not telling you to do this, we're just recommending this. Well, I've often said that's like when Tony Soprano recommends you do something. You know that there's the power of the state behind it. There are guys who come barreling in through your office with bulletproof vests and guns and helmets. So their suggestion becomes a de facto mandate. And that's what happened, by the way, all of the states, when the CDC came out with its guideline back in 2016, which has since been subject to so much criticism and found to be so unscientific that they decided this last year in 2022 to revise it, 38 states took those recommendations that they emphatically said, these are recommendations, these are not mandates, and they made them into law, including my own state of Arizona. So my state of Arizona has a law saying you can't prescribe more than 90 morphine milligram equivalents of an opioid in a 24-hour period. That was put into the statute. So I argued before the committee involved in this in the Arizona legislature. I told them, by the way, that's going to be removed in the 2022, which it was. But it doesn't matter because Arizonans are going to be stuck under a now completely discredited six-year-old understanding of opioids because that's the law in Arizona. So the law is not at all in keeping with the science. And I said, I recommend that you don't put these things into law because you cannot, when you codify a moment's understanding of the medical science literature, you're basically freezing it and casting in stone what a week later could turn out to be all wrong. So stay away from that. So I would recommend that states repeal those dosage limits and stop putting into statute, if they haven't done so yet, how to treat a disease. You can't put that in the statute. We doctors go to meetings several times a year, listening to presentations by researchers and clinicians about the latest understanding of how to treat a disease or the latest new drug or the latest, or we used to think that this was the right way to do it, but now our experience is showing actually that's not the right way. That's our job as doctors to constantly educate ourselves about this. You can't put this into law. Just let our organizations, like our professional societies, and of course we have licensing boards, that's their job. So leave it to them. And so I'm hoping, because another thing that's happening is as drug war II has really affected a lot of middle class, the majority of the I think most Americans now know somebody who's been undertreated for pain or has been cut off from pain medicine, or who maybe committed suicide from being cut off from pain medicine. It's starting to affect enough of the population where patients are mobilizing. Yeah. And I think that's where you're going to start speaking to see how this respond.
So let's talk about that, because I think few policymakers have been as impactful on a national and state level as you have. And I think it's a testament to your tenacity and commitment to this cause. Let's say I'm a pain patient in Montana or in Florida. How can I get a hold of you? How can I get this paper into the hands of the state and local policymakers to ensure that I'm treated properly as a patient?
Well, first of all, it's important to make clear that the Cato Institute, where I work, we are a nonprofit and we're nonpartisan. We don't do any lobbying for specific legislation. Okay, we obviously advocate for certain policy proposals, so if anybody wants to get a hold of this paper, it's very accessible. You just go to the Cato Institute website, which is cato.org. Right at this moment that we're recording this, the Cops Practicing Medicine earthquake is on the homepage, but eventually they refresh the homepage with newer stuff. So all you have to do is you could go in the search engine, Cops Practicing Medicine, or on the top of the page where it says experts, there's a drop-down menu, you could find me, click on my page, and it'll be there. And then you could download it, you could distribute it, you could ask people at the Cato Institute to mail you hard copies if you want. I know most people find the digital version is more convenient these days. So that's one thing you could do. And then if you know state legislators who are open to the idea of changing the existing laws. We actually have a department at Cato called State Affairs, where we have people who work with state lawmakers, governors, state policymakers. Again, we will not specifically, you know, like write a specific bill out, but we will consult and say, this is the kind of thing you need to accomplish. And if we're asked to comment, well, what do you think about this? We'll say what we think about it, whether we think it's, you know, lacking or that's a good step in the right direction. So if you know of policymakers, you could put them either in touch with me or with the Cato Institute State Affairs Department, who will then get in touch with me anyway, because I'm the person they work with on this. And so we oftentimes meet with state and federal legislators. I'm out to Washington every couple of months for the Cato Institute. And when I'm there, our government affairs people always make it a point of arranging for meetings with me, with members of this House and Senate and both parties, as well as members of the administration. There are, contrary to what people think, in both parties, there are members of the House and Senate who are very sensitive to this issue and are aware of the damage that's been done by the drug war and all of the unintended harm it's inflicted on patients.
Thank you so much for your advocacy, Dr. Singer. For those who are listening, I will put his contact information and the direct link to the State Affairs page on the Cato Institute available for everybody who's listening to the podcast on the Daily Remedy homepage. And with that, Dr. Singer, thank you as always for your time. It's always great to hear from you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.